go check my rotor. If I can spend the whole weekend with you, I won't be working over. There ain't nothing more worthwhile to do. You go check your rotor.
Started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The vote in favor of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, and the vote against was 148 votes. And therefore, I can announce that the Parliamentary Party does have confidence. Yeah. Yeah.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson survives a no-confidence vote, barely. We'll get the latest. Then we go to Uvalde, Texas, as funerals continue for the 19 fourth graders and two teachers shot dead 2 weeks ago. We'll speak with Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez.
No community should have to go through what the people in Uvalde had to deal with. families are shattered. We need change in Texas. We need change in the United States. It's my hope that by keeping up this pressure, Greg Abbott will do the right thing, change the laws so that no family in Texas will have to deal with this again.
As calls for investigations grow, we'll also look at threats to the press in Uvalde, like journalists trying to cover the funerals being blocked by bikers called in by the police. We'll speak to Nora Lopez, executive editor of the San Antonio Express News, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Plus, we talk to investigative journalist Carrie Blakinger about her new memoir out today, Corrections in Ink, describing her journey from addiction to prison to the newsroom.
I wrote this book to help humanize prisoners, to help humanize people that were in the situation I was in, and to also show people that second chances are possible, and to show what the barriers are to people actually realizing those second chances.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine's government says more than 40,000 civilians have been killed or wounded in fighting since Russia invaded in late February, with some 3 million Ukrainians now living under Russian occupation. On Monday, President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukrainian forces are continuing to fight pitched battles in the eastern city of Severodonetsk, but that his troops are outnumbered and losing ground. Meanwhile, bombs and shells continue to rain down on rural communities near the front lines. One person was killed, another injured in the town of Druzhkivka, where residents woke Sunday to the sound of explosions and shattering glass.
You can see for yourself what happened. What else can I say? I have been left homeless in my old age.
The United Nations is demanding an independent investigation into charges of rape and sexual assault committed by Russian soldiers in Ukraine. Pramila Patton, the UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict, told the UN Security Council Monday about multiple shocking reports ranging from gang rape to coercion, where loved ones are forced to watch an act of sexual violence committed against a partner or a child. European Council President Charles Michel condemned the findings.
We hear reports of Russian forces wielding sexual violence as a weapon of war. Sexual violence is a war crime, a crime against humanity, a tactic of torture, terror, and repression. Shameful acts in a shameful war.
The European Council president also said Russia was solely responsible for triggering a global food crisis by invading Ukraine. The accusations prompted Russia's ambassador to the UN to storm out of the UN Security Council meeting in protest. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has confirmed he will not attend the Summit of the Americas after the Biden administration excluded the governments of Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
I am not going to the summit because not all the countries of America are invited. I believe in the need to change the policy imposed for centuries of exclusion, of wanting to dominate without any reason, and not respecting each country's sovereignty and independence. There cannot be a summit of the Americas if all the American continent countries do not participate.
The Summit of the Americas opened in Los Angeles Monday. It's the first time taking place in the United States since 1994. At the White House, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said President Biden stood by his decision to exclude Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
We just don't believe dictators should be invited, and so we don't regret that, and the president will stand by his principle.
President Biden's still planning a trip to Saudi Arabia in July to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. In immigration news, a caravan of at least 6,000 people departed from the southern Mexican city of Tapachula on Monday, hoping to reach the U.S.-Mexico border in search of refuge. Many of the caravan members are from Venezuela and Cuba, two nations that have been deeply affected by U.S. economic sanctions. The caravan coincides with the start of the Summit of the Americas, where leaders plan to discuss migration. This is caravan organizer Luis García Villagrán.
We tell the leaders we are not anyone's currency. We are not going to wait until the Mexican Commission for Refugee Assistance decides on our fate in August. Today, we are not going to allow the National Institute for Migration to take until September to give us a solution. Today, the free citizens of Latin America walk out of this immigration prison that our officials are willing to turn Tapachula into.
In London, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson survived a vote of no confidence held Monday by members of his own Conservative Party.
The vote in favor of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, and the vote against was 148 votes. And therefore, I can announce that the Parliamentary Party does have confidence. Yeah.
Prime Minister Johnson faced widespread criticism after Scotland Yard found his government held at least a dozen parties at government buildings, including the Prime Minister's official residence at 10 Downing Street, during the first year of the pandemic in violation of Johnson's COVID lockdown orders. Johnson described Monday's no-confidence vote as good news for UK. Meanwhile, Keir Starmer of the opposition Labour Party reiterated his call for Johnson to resign. Later in the broadcast, we'll go to the UK for the latest. Back in the United States, House Democrats are poised to pass new legislation this week that would raise the legal age of purchase for some semi-automatic rifles to 21, promote safe storage of firearms, ban the sale of large-capacity magazines. Those measures appear doomed in the Senate, where they would need the support of at least 10 Republicans to break a filibuster. On Monday, Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn said GOP senators need at least another week to nail down a bipartisan deal on gun violence. This comes amidst a steady drumbeat of shootings across the United States. On Monday, Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner said a weekend mass shooting began when two men licensed to carry firearms traded 17 shots on a street packed with innocent bystanders. Three people were killed. 11 others were struck by bullets. Krasner called on lawmakers to take action on gun violence immediately.
Any legislator who is not willing to put the lives of innocent bystanders, of women and children and young adults above their political future belongs out of office. And I don't care whether they're Republican or Democrat.
Here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul has signed a package of 10 new gun control bills. Hochul said at a signing ceremony Monday the new measures will close loopholes that allowed the Buffalo shooter to evade a red flag law that should have prevented him from purchasing the semi-automatic rifles used in last month's assault.
In New York, we are taking bold, strong action. We're tightening the red flag laws to keep guns away from dangerous people. And we're raising the age of semi-automatic weapons so no 18-year-old can walk in on their birthday and walk out with an AR-15. Those days are over.
Governor Hochul signed the legislation as the U.S. Supreme Court nears a ruling on whether to strike down a 108-year-old New York state law, making it difficult for gun owners to get a permit to carry a firearm outside the home. During oral arguments in November, the court's conservative majority appeared sympathetic to claims that the Second Amendment guarantees people the right to carry a gun for self-defense. Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio and four other leaders of the far-right group have been charged with seditious conspiracy over their roles in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Tarrio already faced charges of obstructing Congress, destruction of government property, and other crimes. This comes just days after Proud Boys member Josh Pruitt pleaded guilty to a felony charge of obstructing an official proceeding. Pruitt and another man were filmed on January 6th approaching Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and a security detail inside the Capitol Visitor Center after forcing their way into the building, prompting Senator Schumer to run away. In Texas, progressive primary challenger Jessica Cisneros has formally requested a recount in her May runoff election with Democratic incumbent Congressmember Henry Cuellar. As of Monday, Cisneros trailed Cuellar by just 187 votes. Cuellar is a corporate-backed, anti-choice, pro-gun Democrat who's twice declared victory in the race. The FBI raided his home and campaign office in January as part of a corruption investigation. Cisneros said in a statement, quote, "Our movement was never just about the one politician. It was about taking on an unjust system that rewards corruption and corporate profits at the expense of the needs of working people," Jessica Cisneros said. And in Brazil, Fear is growing over the safety of British journalist Dom Phillips and Bruno Pereira, a protector of Brazilian indigenous communities, after the pair went missing in one of the most remote areas of the Amazon early Sunday. Phillips is a longtime freelance reporter for The Guardian and other publications. Pereira is a former Brazilian government official. The two were last seen while traveling by boat in the northern Brazilian state of Amazonas, near the border with Peru. Phillips was doing research for a book on the Amazon and was in the region to interview indigenous leaders patrolling the area for illegal miners and fishers. Pereira had recently received death threats over his work. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has survived a vote of no confidence held by members of his own Conservative Party. On Monday, Conservatives voted 211 to 148 by secret ballot to allow Johnson to remain leader of the party. The vote came days after Johnson was booed when he arrived at a service to honor the Queen's 70-year reign. Johnson recently became the first British leader to be sanctioned for breaking the law while in office, after a report by Scotland Yard found Johnson's government held at least a dozen parties at the Prime Minister's official residence during the first year of the pandemic in violation of Johnson's COVID lockdown orders. On Monday night, Johnson described the vote as good news for the UK.
So, well, I think this is a very good result for politics and for the country.
Just in it's
just I do just in this sense, I think it's a convincing result, a decisive result, and what it means is that as a government, we can move on and focus on the stuff that I think really matters to people.
For more, we're joined by Professor Priya Gopal at the University of Cambridge, author of Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Dissent. Professor Gopal, welcome back to Democracy Now! Good news for the empire. Can you talk about this no confidence vote? If just 30 MPs had voted a different way, 30 some odd MPs, he would have gone down.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to be back. The significance of this vote is that it isn't, in fact, good news for Johnson at all. It is pretty much the first time that the Conservative Party has in any way, even in this very divided way, held Johnson to account for, you know, what has been a very long record of being quite flexible with the truth and for breaking ministerial rules. I think that this reflects a mood shift among voters who handed Johnson a huge majority at the last elections. He's gone from being seen as a kind of Teflon prime minister to someone who is now very vulnerable. And his prime ministership, I think it is widely agreed, is in some danger. And this is quite remarkable given how much he has actually been able to withstand over his 2.5 years in office, from multiple charges of dishonesty and misleading the public, cronyism charges over COVID contracts to ministers and family of Tory, to friends and family of Tory ministers, proroguing parliament, suspending parliament, breaking manifesto promises over pensions, health and social care, to luxury refurbishments of his official residence. And of course, let's not forget a staggeringly high COVID death toll, 179,000 at last count. So actually for Johnson, this is really bad news, because this is the first time nearly half of his party has wrapped him on the knuckles and has basically sent a warning shot across his bowels that, you know, he is not safe anymore. So he might try to bluster as usual and call it good news. But I think for him, it's very, very bad news.
And Professor Gopal, what's your sense of the likelihood of new elections being called or Johnson being forced to resign?
Well, I think that really depends. He is safe under current rules from a leadership challenge for at least 1 year. There is talk about changing the rules to allow for a challenge earlier, but that remains to be seen. I don't think new elections are necessarily on the horizon, but what is clear is that he has a large number of rebels in the Tory ranks. And this means that any legislation that he tries to put forward may not go through because of dissension from within the Tory party. And if it turns out that he isn't able to function, isn't able to put legislation through that he wants to put through, then he may be in a position where he is indeed forced to resign. So he isn't quite a lame duck yet, but he is certainly in quite a lot of danger of not being able to do the things that he wants to do. So it remains to be seen how the next weeks and months progress. Certainly, prime ministers in similar positions, most recently Theresa May, even when they have survived confidence vote, with even fewer rebels, have not been able to survive very long. So he is not at all in a safe and happy position.
And speaking of things that he still hopes to accomplish, what about his ability now to resolve the situation regarding Ireland and the post-Brexit, the arrangements in terms of Ireland and the both the UK and the European Union?
Yeah, I think that element of Brexit is in trouble. Johnson's line to his party and to the electorate has been that he got Brexit done. But in fact, Brexit is not done. We are now in a position where Britain is likely, if things go as he plans, to be in breach of the withdrawal agreement, putting the Good Friday Agreement that brought peace to Ireland in great danger. This is by no means resolved. The EU is not going to turn around and simply roll over if the United Kingdom withdraws, as Johnson is threatening to, unilaterally from the withdrawal agreement, reimposing a hard border, essentially, in Ireland. So what we are looking at is a mess, and that is the kindest thing that one can say about the situation in relation to Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. There is a really big problem on hand, and it is very far from resolved, and Brexit is very far from being done.
I mean, it's particularly incredible seeing the prime minister at these parties at 10 Downing Street, when let's not forget, he almost died of COVID himself. But I wanted to end by asking you about the last days in Britain. I didn't say the last days of Britain, but the last days in Britain. Just coming off the Platinum Jubilee celebrations, marking 70 years of the Queen's reign. We saw the images of Boris Johnson being booed as he came out for the celebration. But the significance of this 70th Jubilee, Professor Gopal, as author of Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Dissent.
Well, I mean, the Jubilee, you know, is a very interesting event because Johnson was booed not by leftists, not by Labour voters, but he was booed by royalists who had gathered in force outside St. Paul's Cathedral. And that was a very telling moment because these are natural conservative voters who had come out to celebrate the monarchy and was booing a conservative prime minister. But the Jubilee itself is very telling. Here we have huge public expenditure for 4 days. I mean, some figures suggest 28 million pounds spent for ritual genuflection to one of the world's richest institutions at a time when, let us not forget, Britain is in very deep economic trouble. We have inflation at 10%. We have enormous inequality. We have record numbers of children going hungry, record numbers of working families having to use food banks. We have, essentially people having to choose between heating and eating. Energy prices are fantastically high. And this is a situation in which we have chosen to celebrate the wealthy and essentially chosen to celebrate rule by the wealthy, given, you know, huge public expenditure, I think. And of course, around the empire, there was deep dishonesty in the celebrations. There was no reference to empire. There was no reference to the troubles and bloodshed that empire entailed at the very beginning of Queen Elizabeth II's rule. And the Jubilee, I think, really says everything we need to know about present-day Britain, celebration of wealth and the wealthy, while ordinary people are going without and suffering in very large numbers.
Priya Gopal, we thank you for being with us. English professor, University of Cambridge, author of Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Descent. Next up, we head to Uvalde, Texas, where funerals are continuing for the 19 fourth graders and their two teachers shot dead 2 weeks ago, as calls for investigations grow. And journalists trying to cover the funerals are being blocked by bikers called in by the police. We'll get an update from Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez and the San Antonio Express News editor Nora Lopez, head of the NAHJ, National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Stay with us. By Massive Attack featuring Hope Sandoval. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Funerals are continuing in Uvalde, Texas, for the 19 fourth graders and their two teachers, shot dead at Robb Elementary School 2 weeks ago by an 18-year-old gunman. On Monday, a funeral was held for Eliana Ellie Garcia, one day after what would have been her 10th birthday. Meanwhile, more questions are being raised about how local police responded to the mass shooting and why they waited over an hour before anyone confronted the gunman. One teacher who survived the massacre, Arnulfo Reyes, has spoken out for the first time. He spoke to ABC News from the hospital where he's recovering after being shot twice in the attack. All 11 of his students in his classroom were killed. Arnulfo Reyes described hearing a student in a neighboring classroom pleading with police officers in the hallway for help.
One of the students from the next door classroom was saying, "Officer, we're in here. We're in here." But they had already left. And then he got up from my behind my desk and he walked over there and he shot over there again.
On Wednesday, an 11-year-old student who survived the massacre, Mia Cerillo, is scheduled to testify in Washington, D.C. during a House hearing on gun violence. Mia avoided being murdered by smearing herself with blood from a friend who'd been shot dead. We turn now to Roland Gutierrez, the Democratic state senator whose district includes Uvalde. State Senator, welcome back to Democracy Now! We wanted to go to what you understand at this point. I mean, what looks like just a clear cover-up. Can you talk about your texting back and forth with the head of DPS, the Department of Public Safety, guaranteeing you would learn about all these officers in the hallway and what happened by last Friday, but then being told by him that he's been ordered not to tell you this information?
Yes, Amy, thank you, first off, for continuing to shed light on this. It's so very important. I had a very, and I still have a good communication with Steve McCraw on other issues. But unfortunately, as of last Friday, he was ordered to not communicate any further reports to me. That order was put in place by the local district attorney, who is claiming to have taken over this investigation. Mind you, this Republican district attorney has a staff of two or three. She has called on four other lawyers from sort of the surrounding area to try to help her with this massive, massive investigation. You mentioned Ellie Garcia. I went to her viewing on Sunday, and I find it just so compelling. Ellie was shrouded. She had a shroud over her. This is the most infamous day in Texas's recent history. And what happened on that day will remain shrouded as long as Greg Abbott has it so. And so we are in this space right now in Texas where we can get no answers to what happened and why those students waited for 45 minutes for officers to go in.
And Senator, I wanted to ask you, we've discussed this previously, this whole issue of the incident commander, and it seems that most of the blame is being placed on Chief Arredondo. Does it make sense to you that the Texas Department of Public Safety, the main state police organization in Texas, since their officers were on the scene, would have deferred to a local school police chief in an instance like this?
Well, it makes no sense to me. They're the superior authority. DPS always comes to us when we have meetings, neighborhood meetings and such, and they talk about command and control. They are the superior force in that area, especially after Greg Abbott, voted to put in $4 billion on the border over the last year. There was, at least from what I know in my last communication with Steve McCraw, at first there was two officers in that hallway. My last phone call, he said there was between two and as many as 13. At what point does the superior agency not say, hey, I'm taking over here, whether that be the police or the sheriff's department, or the or DPS? At what point does that not happen? One other thing that I find compelling here. Again, in our last phone calls, I'm told that Arredondo did not have his radio communications, and that has also been reported by the New York Times independently. If Arredondo doesn't have his radio comms, how in the world is he the incident commander? Who makes him the incident commander? Does he wear a shirt that says incident commander? Does he raise his hand? It defies any kind of logic that this man was in charge. And so I hope that he comes out, speaks out, tells us the truth about what happened. We've heard from the Uvalde Leader, the newspaper in the area, in an editorial. They used a couple of phrases in their editorial. They said officers were frozen. So I don't know if they're speaking to their local ISD police or their UPD, but at some point, I think that, and that's my hope, that we'll be able to start hearing from some of these officers. And it's important not to cast blame, but it is important to ensure that this doesn't happen again anywhere in Texas, and God forbid that it does. But unfortunately, with the current state of political affairs and a governor that simply doesn't listen, five massacres in and has done nothing to change gun laws, unfortunately, we know that it will.
And Senator, what do you see as the significance that there's a possible grand jury already impaneled here and raising the possibility that some people could be indicted in relation to this situation other than the actual shooter?
Well, because we don't know what that means, they've just raised this possibility. If it's actors or folks on social media or cohorts of this person, well, that's one thing for sure. But if it's this law enforcement component, I can't understand for the life of me why policymakers and the public in general and the community in general cannot get the answers of the logistics of what went on. the situational logistics. What I specifically asked for, what I was going to receive on Friday, that was stymied by the district attorney, was which officers were in their hallways. I didn't want their identities. I didn't want to know that, you know, Juan Sanchez or John Smith was in that hallway. I wanted to know how many troopers were in there, because those troopers are accountable to the state legislature, how many sheriff's deputies, how many ISD, so that I can then for myself determine this notion, at least, or at least infer this situational control piece. It's important so that in the future, as Steve McCraw told me in one conversation where we were yelling and crying at each other, that this will never happen again. He specifically said that DPS will no longer stand down to any force again. And that's compelling and that's nice to say. But I don't think that that's what happened here. Inferentially, I can tell you that I just feel that all of these people, including the ISD cop, it was just frozen. And I could imagine, and I understand that fear. That 45 minutes to them probably went by in 4.5. And to those parents outside, it was 45 hours. It was just, it's just devastating what we
did. And let's not forget those parents outside trying to get inside, being held back by police. They're begging for their guns and their shields. They said, if you won't go in, we will go in. But I wanted to ask you, State Senator Roland Gutierrez, on this issue of the state of Texas. Governor Abbott has said he's setting up a commission. I assume you weren't invited to be a part of that commission, though you represent Uvalde. You've called for not a commission, but a special session. What exactly do you want to see Texas pass in terms of gun laws?
Well, we don't get anywhere with special commissions. After Santa Fe, he had roundtables, which I assume went round and round and came up with nothing. After El Paso, he sat down and had recommendations that were issued to the legislature. Now he's calling for this new nomenclature of a special commission. Listen, there's nothing happening here other than Greg Abbott bamboozling the people of the state of Texas with the word special. A special session is a legal term in our statutes by which the governor can call us back for a 30-day time certain period beginning on a date certain and ending on a date certain. Those are the days that we have by which to work when we are not in session. And we meet in committees, not special committees, but in committees. We take witness testimony. We take expert testimony. We take the public's testimony. And then we formulate bills. Those bills, is like any other state, they go to the House, they go to the Senate, they go to the governor's desk. Without that, this special committee is nothing more than a joke that will do nothing. Will I be there? Sure. I'll ask some questions. Are they concerned that I'm going to politicize it? Listen, if we're not talking about guns, then I very well don't see the benefit in it at all. I might have a meeting of my own outside, you know, with real gun experts, folks from Sandy Hook, folks from Colorado, from Florida, from Parkland, from Aurora. We have to be able to understand that there's this basic thing here. And that's what Kathy Hochul did yesterday. An 18-year-old should not go into a gun shop on his 18th birthday or the day after and shop for an AR-15, ammo the next day, and then another AR-15, as if he was going to the 7-Eleven to buy a Slurpee. That's how easy it was for this young man. Where's the human red flag of that local store saying there's something wrong here? But what's wrong is that there's something wrong in Texas because greed has come into play. The NRA greed, that store owner's greed, Greg Abbott's greed, his absence of leadership on this issue. And Republican constituents want change themselves, and he's just not listening.
At a church service on the Sunday after the shooting, Bella Barboza, who is 11 years old, spoke about her friend Ellie Garcia, who was killed during the massacre at Robb Elementary School. Ellie had been set to celebrate her 10th birthday.
She was, Ellie was a very bright girl. She made a huge impact on the church. She was very kind and very active and very confident. remember we were painting jars for Mother's Day, and I was washing mine off because I didn't like it, and we were in the restroom, and I dropped it, and she's like, your mom's gonna get mad, and we were laughing together, just looking at the glass on the floor, and it was funny. It was shocking, because I had faith that she was in the other room, but when I found out, I was just like, well, she's in a better place now, and if this happens again, she doesn't have to go through that.
If this happens again. We turn now to look at threats to the media in Uvalde, Texas. Houston Chronicle reporter Julian Gill tweeted that while he was reporting on the funeral of one of the students killed in the elementary school massacre, several members of the biker club, Guardians of the Children, followed, blocked, and surrounded him as he tried to approach a cemetery to meet a photographer. One of the bikers, guys on motorcycles, told him they were working with police who asked them to be there. Gill shared this video of his exchange with police and the biker club.
How's it going? How's it going? How are you?
Doing good. With Lubbock PD?
Yes, sir.
Say, we're Guardians of the Children. We're a nonprofit 501c3. We work with victims of child abuse, sexual assault, things of that nature.
Okay.
Say, we're out here to provide a little bit of comfort and support for the families, help give them some space.
Sure.
Let them grieve in peace.
Okay.
So, you know, we just thought we'd come out, help some kids.
Sure.
Help some families in need. How you doing today? Oh, man,
I'm sorry.
Don't bump into me, dude.
I'm just trying to do my job, sir.
I understand, but...
I'm sorry, are you a police officer?
We're working with the police. I asked us to be.
You're working with police?
No. We are here to give the family space and time to grieve.
Well, I just got you on video saying you're working with police.
That's just one example of the bikers confronting reporters in Uvalde, Texas, as officials there face increasing accusations of stonewalling the media. For more, we're joined by Nora Lopez, executive editor of the San Antonio Express News, also the president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, just like my colleague Juan Gonzalez was. Nora, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what is happening with the press there, the stonewalling? Start with these bikers.
Well, first, thank you, Amy. And hi, Juan. Thank you both for inviting me to be on the show to talk about this really important topic and what's happening right now in Uvalde. Well, as you saw from Julian's video, and I should explain that the Houston Chronicle is our sister paper. We're both owned by Hearst. So we've had reporters from both papers in Uvalde reporting for both papers. You know, the incident that you showed was from Thursday, and that's when there were a lot of biker motorcycle clubs there who were telling us that they were there at the request of the police. To be entirely honest, we've never been able to confirm that from police themselves telling us that, yes, they invited them. But since then, actually, I think it was State Senator Gutierrez who helped us. They sort of backed down a little bit. But, you know, more troubling is that the police has continued to also block access and, you know, basically harass reporters. As recently as Saturday and Sunday, one of my photographers was confronted by a police officer. And these are police officers who are not even from Uvalde. There's about a dozen law enforcement agencies across the state who have sent some police officers there to help because Uvalde is so small. And yes, they've been overrun with both people who want to come from out of town to pay the respects and, of course, the media. So this treatment has continued, and it's honestly, it's intolerable. They are blocking access to... get close to the cemetery or to the churches or to the funeral home.
are more than 90% Latino, and that in the entire state of Texas, of more than 5 million public school students, more than 52% are of Latinx descent. And yet what's been happening in terms of getting out the word by law enforcement to the Spanish-speaking community?
Well, you know, as that very first press conference, they were taking questions, and I think it was already wrapping up. And one of the Spanish language reporters asked, you know, can somebody speak to us in Spanish? And I think at that point they were basically ignored. Nobody said anything. And it was they got a lot of criticism on social media about this. So the very next day when they had a press conference, the first thing they said was, well, we'll have somebody available after to speak to Spanish language in Spanish. And I've reached out to both Telemundo and Univision reporters, and they've said it's gotten a little bit better. They don't have anybody officially, but they've been able to find, officers who can speak Spanish, who have been able to tell them a little bit. But it's not the same thing as you and I both know as journalists, to have those officials who have the facts as relate to them to speak to Spanish language. So that is a concern, and it's a historical concern. Spanish language media gets treated like second class citizens at these types of events, and they're basically left on their own to try to find someone who can do a stand up in Spanish for them. But they do their job. I mean, this is not new to them. It's pretty routine, and so they do what they need to do to find the people to talk to them in Spanish and help give, you know, accurate reports to the public in their own language.
And in terms of the overall police response, the lack of information so many days after this tragedy, as a veteran journalist, have you ever seen such difficulty in terms of getting just the basic facts of what happened and who was there, and not having all these corrections constantly issued by law enforcement?
None. I've never seen anything like this. I'm a former police reporter. I've covered police in Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio, and I've never seen a response like this. And, you know, every day some little new incident comes up that directly contradicts what we were initially told. So this is unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this. And what really concerns me, one, is two things. One, you know, that police are actively obstructing us from doing our jobs. And as you know, news gathering is a constitutional right. So at some point, this will cross into, you know, basically official oppression. So we are exploring our options with our Hearst legal and considering to see if there's any kind of legal option that we have. So that's one thing, and that's a really serious thing. But then the other thing that's equally concerning is that they are actually blocking people from who want to talk to us, from talking to us, from talking to the media. So there is a chilling effect that's going on in Uvalde, and the residents are seeing this, and they are now afraid to talk to us as well. I've heard this from a couple of reporters who've told me that they've had people say, you know, I'm going to get in trouble if I say anything. And I think there was one TV station who has reported the same as that somebody that they know that they were interviewing said that he lost their job. I don't have confirmation of that, but it is a chilling effect that's going on in Uvalde. And
Nora, didn't the mom who was handcuffed trying to get her kids out of the school, handcuffed by police, say that afterwards she got a phone call that if she kept repeating this, that she would be arrested?
Yes, they're saying the same thing to the media. You know, we're walking on a public street, or we're standing on a public sidewalk, and they're telling us you need to move. This is private property, and we're like, no, this is a public street. And they're, if you don't move, we're gonna arrest you. And when we ask them, well, what is the charge? They tell us something vague, like, you know, we're protecting the privacy of the families. So that's a really strange charge, something that's not on the books that I'm aware of. So it's a chilling effect. But make no mistake, the San Antonio Express News is not going to pull out. We are the big city paper that's closest. And just as we did when we covered Sutherland, we will remain there for the long haul, because these people deserve their story to be told. And we don't want this tragedy to be just, you know, swept under the rug. There needs to be shine a light on what happened here. And there is so much that we don't know, so much that we don't know.
Nora Lopez, I want to thank you so much for being with us now and being out there with your reporters. Executive editor of the San Antonio Express News, also president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Next up, we speak to investigative journalist Carrie Blakinger about her new memoir out today, Corrections in Ink, describing her journey from addiction to prison to the newsroom. Stay with us.
Sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine. Sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine. Sunshine. Folks get down in the sunshine. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Sunshine. Yeah. Folks get brown in the sunshine.
Everybody Loves the Sunshine by Roy Ayers Ubiquity. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a national broadcast exclusive with one of the leading criminal justice reporters in the country, whose new memoir is out today. It describes her journey from addiction to prison to the newsroom. Carrie Blakinger is an investigative journalist based in Houston, Texas, where she covers criminal justice and injustice for the Marshall Project. She's the organization's first formerly incarcerated reporter. Her book, Corrections in Ink, details her path from aspiring professional figure skater to when she struggled and turned to drugs at age 17 and ultimately landed in prison after she was arrested with 6 ounces of heroin in her final semester of her senior year at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Carrie Blakinger, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Congratulations on the publication of your book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to start there. Before we talk about your time in prison and how it shaped your reporting, talk about your arrest in 2010 on the streets of Ithaca, where you were going to Cornell, and the charges you faced.
Yeah, one of the things that I think about a lot in terms of that arrest and how that all played out is how differently that could have gone if it was just a few years earlier. I got arrested in 2010, which was just after they'd repealed the Rockefeller drug laws. They got progressively repealed between 2004 and 2009. And by the time I got arrested, I was able to get a sentence of 2.5 years, and I ended up serving 21 months. But had I been arrested, you know, a few years earlier, I would have gotten 15 to life and I would still be in prison and not even eligible for parole yet. So I think about that a lot when I think about that day that I got arrested.
And Carrie, I wanted to ask you about the in your book, you talk quite extensively and very eloquently about the conditions that women face in prison. Strangely enough, that about the availability of drugs, the very thing that you were arrested and jailed for within the prison, and also the abuse of solitary confinement. Could you talk about those things?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that a lot of people think, I mean, even now I have a lot of people saying it to me, that you can send someone to prison and at least they'll get clean, they'll get off drugs because there won't be drugs there. And that's just not true. And I think a lot of people still don't know that. I mean, I could get heroin delivered to my bedside in prison. So when people stay off drugs behind bars, you know, that also takes effort in a way that I don't think people appreciate. And, you know, throwing someone in jail or prison is no guarantee that they're forced to stay off drugs.
Kerry, your time in prison, the description, I mean, the darkness of this period in your life, if you can talk about how you got the drugs in and then the guards full well knowing that you were completely out of it. You were drugged out.
Yeah, when I got arrested, I had a lot of drugs on me, and I had some that I ended up bringing in with me into the jail. And I think it was pretty apparent that I was quite high those first few days, but I don't think they necessarily knew what to do. And, you know, I was so out of it that at one point I remembered them discussing whether I really needed to be taken to court. But I was also very lucky because after I came off those drugs, that was a jail that at that time had Suboxone, which is something that is used to, you know, to help treat opioid addiction. And it's usually used long term to help prevent relapse and minimize cravings and prevent overdose. And they did not offer it long term, but they did at least offer it short term. And I know that a lot of people will think that a drug that can help minimize the pain of detox is just coddling addicts. I hear this a lot. But I think it was actually really important for me because that meant that I wasn't trying to find drugs. When there were drugs available, I wasn't trying to continue getting high behind bars. And I had a little bit of clarity in those first few weeks after my arrest to help make really important decisions about whether to stay off drugs, about what I wanted to do, you know, legally. And I think that having that help ease detox actually was a lifesaver for me.
You have a new piece out headlined Why We Didn't Celebrate Gay Pride Month in Women's Prison. Women's prison was the queerest place I've ever been and one of the most homophobic. Just explain the disparity.
Yeah, there's a few ways that's true. I mean, first of all, just on a base level, it's the only place I've ever been where, you know, you would actually be punished with, you know, with torture, with solitary confinement for acting out on anything, you know, on anything gay, on anything same sex. Because it wasn't just sex that's banned in prison. It's also, you know, you can't touch other prisoners. You can't hug. You can't, you know, stroke someone's hair. This is all technically against the rules. And that's the only place I've lived where that's ever, you know, where that's ever punishable. But there was also this, you know, this undercurrent in the culture, I think, of some sort of, I don't know, institutionalized bigotry in some ways. I mean, what we called it when you got in trouble for any same-sex interaction was a DG, which is short for Degenerate Act. And that wasn't the official name in the rule book, but that's what the staff called it, and that's what the prisoners called it. And I think it says so much about how they and we saw that.
And, Kerry, once you got out of prison, you were able to get a second chance, graduate from college, you became an investigative reporter. Could you talk about that transition and why, as you note, you had that opportunity, but many others don't?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think that that's one of the really important things about this book. On the one hand, I want to give hope to people who are inside to see that it's possible to have second chances, but I think it's also really important for people to understand, you know, people on the outside to understand what the barriers are and why not everyone ends up with the sort of success story that I've been able to have. And a lot of that, of course, is the, you know, racial and class privilege issues that, you know, y'all are of course, well aware of. I think that one of the ways that it's really important to understand how it plays out in a story like mine is sort of cumulative over the years. I think, for instance, that by the time I got arrested, I'd had so many interactions with police over the years that could have gone very differently if I were black or brown. There's so many times where I was clearly doing things that were suspicious that could have resulted in more arrests and a longer criminal record, so that by the time I actually got arrested in 2010, I might have had, you know, far more priors and qualified for a much harsher sentence, done longer, gone to prison where black and brown people are more likely to get tickets that send them to solitary and thus, you know, less likely to make parole, ended up doing more time, spent more time away from the community and my family. And, you know, by the time I got out, it would have been that much harder to reintegrate before, you know, facing all of the same systemic barriers that exist for, you know, black and brown people on the outside.
And could you talk about how your experience has informed and propelled you to cover criminal justice issues, especially now with the Marshall Project?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that, first of all, I think it's given me a starting point of understanding that people in prison are people. And I think that might sound obvious, but very commonly people sort of think of prisoners as faceless numbers, because it's really hard to actually have lots of meaningful interactions with prisoners. You know, prisons are inherently hard to get in. You know, they're behind razor wire. Access is so limited. So I think that just having that starting point has, you know, given me the perspective that there are other things about prisoners that are worth covering. And I think that's made a big difference. But, you know, I also think that there's a lot of prisoners who've been more willing to speak to me because they know that I know that. They know that I come from a starting point of seeing them as human.
Finally, Carrie, dentures. We have 1 minute. Why are dentures so important?
Well, I mean, I think that just it's a body part. Like on a base level, this is a body part that many prisons, you know, were not giving to prisoners. And having them can be so important in terms of confidence and, you know, just feeling like you're being treated like a person, but also in terms of reentry and, you know, coming out and looking as employable as possible.
And so explain what you did.
In Texas prisons, they'd been routinely denying dentures to toothless prisoners. They would take the food and put it in a blender, puree it, and, you know, just pour it in a cup. And I investigated this for almost a year and wrote a story about it. And afterwards, the Texas prison system bought a 3D printer to be able to start 3D printing dentures for prisoners.
Well, Carrie Blakinger, this book is astounding. Carrie is an investigative reporter in Texas for the Marshall Project. Her column is called Inside Out, that she does with NBC News and Marshall. Her new memoir out today, Corrections in Ink. We will continue our conversation in a part two at democracynow.org. We'll also link to her columns online. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren, Camille Baker, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari A Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.